You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to this edition of Off Script, American Theater's podcast about all things theatrical. I'm the editor-in-chief, Rob Weiner Kent. I'm here with...
I'm Susie Evans. I'm the senior editor.
Yes, that's your new title.
Deep Tran Associate Editor. My title has not changed.
And Allison Considine, the Editorial Assistant.
And we are here on some brand new equipment with an exciting show.
Do we sound better, everyone?
We hope we do.
We have orange microphones.
They're orange snowballs. they're almost look edible. Let's see. Today we'll talk about the latest in gender parody with The Count. We'll talk about... We all saw the Encore's presentation, or most of the Encore's presentation of recent Andrew Lippa's The Wild Party. Then we have an interview with, we did a TCG with Susan Booth, the Artistic Director of the Alliance Theater in Atlanta. A fun interview that Deep did. And then we'll end with some recommendations / chatter at the end. So, Susie, why don't you tell us about, what's the latest? There was something happened at the Dramatists Guild last week.
Yeah, the Dramatists Guild released the count. They put it together with the Lily Awards, which is an organization that gives awards recognition to women working in the theater, both leaders and artists. I had known about it because I interviewed Julia Jordan about a year ago when we did our big gender parody piece when the Kilroys came out, and she had told me they were trying to start doing it, and it was a big project. And so they released this study on Friday at the Dramatists Guild conference in La Jolla, California. And, yeah, it's a really interesting study. It looks at nonprofit theaters across the country. I think they looked at somewhere between 2,000 productions over the course of 3 years, from 2011 to 2014. Their criteria for choosing productions and theaters was the theater had to have 3 shows in a season, and each of those shows needed to have 21 productions each to count as a theater. So it was mostly the big theaters.
What they define as professional.
Professional, right? Yeah. Like the Alliance and the Goodman and the Steppenwolf and the Kirk Douglas and Center Theater Group. Those are probably the level of theaters. I don't actually have a list of the theaters included or how many theaters they included.
We don't know yet. Okay, we don't know the number.
But we know it's about 2,500 productions that they counted.
And so what would they come up with? This is obviously intended to show... They tagged authorship by gender and then also by race as well.
Yeah, they tagged authorship by race and gender. They had wanted to do it a little bit more in depth when I was first talking to Julia Jordan, who's a co-founder of the Lilies and worked with Marsha Norman and the Guild to get the count put together. Julia had said that they wanted to do it over 5 years instead of 3, and they wanted to count things like cast size and ethnicity and gender of the director, as well as like casting tendencies in second and third productions, like whether a race is like designated for a character or if it's not, and what's the tendency to cast, and how does it vary in different parts of the country. But basically, that became a huge undertaking. So what they did was just the race and the gender of the playwright.
I'm sorry, nationality too, didn't they do?
Did nationality, race, and gender.
And so what were the results? Is the gender parity fight over?
I actually was really discouraged by the number. They all seemed to be encouraged, so maybe I should listen to them. But it was 22% of plays across the country written by women, which is a slight lower than what we counted from TCG member theaters.
Our sample last year.
Which is 24%. I think they're encouraged because the last big study that they keep referring to is the New York State Council for the Arts study that came out in 2002.
And it was 17 or
which
something.
Which is 70%, but it was just New York theaters.
Right.
And this is across the country.
Yeah.
So
I don't know enough about statistics to know what a sample size does to the numbers, whether they're more reliable no matter what field you survey. But, around between 20 and 30, depending on how you count. For instance, our numbers were close to about in the 20s to up to 30, depending whether you said it was a new play. Like, if you looked at new plays, which I think we defined it by world premieres, which is not my favorite way to define a new play. But it was closer to 30 or maybe a little over 30% were by women. which is encouraging, of course, but not great.
Well, I think that's also important to point out that the Count did just looked at contemporary plays. So it was only plays that have been written in the last 50 years.
Right,
so
that's
anything
interesting.
That was pre-1965 didn't get counted in their study.
Did you ask them, I'm sorry, did you ask them why they cut that
no.
off? Then, okay, I just wondered.
I think they're trying to excuse, they're trying to see like what we're looking at now for trends. And they
right.
did also track revivals. So if it had been written 10 years ago or more, it was counted as a revival.
Right, so How I Learned to Drive would be a revival.
Yeah, and so the numbers were like a little bit better for new plays. And so I think it was like 29% for women for new plays
right.
and 13 for revivals.
So the idea is partly that 50-year cutoff is to acknowledge a little bit that in a largely pre-feminist era, like say 65, and it's hard to come up with hard figures for when you know the feminist era begins or when it didn't begin. But that before then, there were structural issues that meant that there weren't women playwrights weren't produced. There were lots
yeah,
of plays
by women. Yeah,
and I
think they're trying
women.
To like not put that into the percentages.
And that would skew because Shakespeare's not even in there. So yeah.
Yeah.
Now there are people who point out that we should count those. And I will say not to elbow in with our own agenda. When we do our season profile coming up in our October issue, we're planning to do our own version of the data. I don't know if we're going to be able to tack. To track race and nationality this time, but we're going to be looking at gender of the playwright and roughly what period it's from. I don't
yeah,
know if we're going
we're,
to go... What are we doing deeper?
We're defining
about
it... We're going to define it in three periods. We're doing classic plays, which we peg, I think, pre-1965. Revivals
okay.
is 1965 to 2005, and new plays is anything within the last 10 years.
Right, so we talked about this. We're sort of adopting the Count's rubric for new play being... contemporary play, let's say, the last 10 years, and then before that, between 10 and 50 years
yeah.
old, is
still a contemporary play, but
not a canonical
mm-hmm.
classic, In any case, it's fascinating numbers, and
well, the numbers that were really fascinating to me, and Julia said this to me on the phone too, that they were fascinating to her, was the city to city numbers.
Right, right.
I mean, Chicago was at 36%. And which is high.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, I mean, because Julia pointed out that a lot of theaters just produced plays that were in New York first, so you kind of expect the numbers to reflect what New York's
what
number
New York
was.
Did. Yeah, yeah.
New York's number was 25%, which is higher than the average. But Chicago's at 36, and so, which means there's a lot of, like, local writers in Chicago that are getting premieres at big theaters.
I mean, that to me, that's a fascinating story that speaks, or trend that speaks not just to gender parity issues, but New York versus local producing. Like, if the numbers don't reflect, if the numbers along these data don't reflect what New York does, that means that something else is going on in the country in general, not just along gender lines, but like they're producing plays not by New York. That'd be another, that's a subject for another study, like how many plays produced in other cities are,
yeah.
you know, we've got the imprint of New York.
Yeah,
and how many didn't, you know?
And I don't remember. Chicago's great. I mean, Chicago dramatists and the Goodman.
They generate a lot of work there.
Yeah. Workshop that generate a lot of work. They also bring in new plays from playwrights who might not be based there, but that didn't start in New York. Like,
yeah.
Like Nita Raine's Tribes started there, didn't it? Or am I lying about
well,
that?
Well, it's English play. It's English play, but it was, I think that might have been its first production.
I think it was in Chicago first, or am I lying?
It was David Cromer. But I think it might have been here. But we'll look it up, folks.
We'll look it up. I might be wrong.
Well,
but
yeah.
they do bring
here.
Playwrights from maybe other cities or other countries and produce
them
first.
Their own, yeah, they have their own relationships with playwrights all over the place, including England.
But I don't remember all of the ethnicity and nationality numbers that they came up with, but I think the overall number of only 12% of plays produced cross-country by playwrights of color, which is pretty staggering.
Yes.
And not surprising.
Those numbers are not
yeah, yeah.
are not encouraging.
They broke it down. If you look at the article on AmericanTheater.org, it's broken down completely by nationality, ethnicity, and gender.
And
so
gender.
You can see like exactly which people, like which group of people is getting which percentage, which
right.
is really
how many women of color.
How many women of color from America?
US,
how many yeah. women of color from outside the U.S.? It's how many white women from outside the U.S.? How many? It's an interesting breakdown.
Right. So we'll stay on that story. I think it's an open secret now that our October issue is going to be, that will be one of its focuses, or foci.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and just some background information for anyone who doesn't know what data it is that we're using. Every summer, we request the complete seasons from 500 member theaters around the country, and then they submit it to us, and then we run the entire listings in our October issue.
Right.
So this year, we're taking it a step further. We're going to take that data, which is about 3,000 shows on average,
right,
and count how many female playwrights are being produced,
right?
What kind of plays are being produced?
The thing that you left out there is that data is where we get our famous top 10
and that is
most produced list. Yeah, and
yes.
Then we've started to have fun with that list already, where we do now a top 20 playwrights,
yeah,
right?
We don't count Shakespeare or Dickens.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
people have problems with us not doing that.
It's a fascinating list every year, and I'm really excited to see the data across the whole field, because one thing that has driven me nuts when people look at the top 10 list is such a great way to look at, just to get a snapshot of what the tastes are, of the field are, you know. But like last year, I think there were only two female playwrights in the top 10 list, and so people then say, oh, there's only 20%. Okay, actually, that's not that far from the number. But but if you look at the larger field of new plays, which is what this top 10 list is mostly new plays, if you dig deep between the numbers, it still disproportionately favors male writers. But the number is not 2 out of 10. It's, you know,
3 out of 10.
It's 3 out of 10, or, you know, on average. No, it's so in any case, I'm interested in looking at the entire data set. A lot of times, playwrights who have written a lot of plays, particularly like Tennessee Williams, Arthur Miller, people like that, are not in our top 10 list because they don't have one hit play everyone wants to do. But there's still going to be a lot of Tennessee Williams and August Wilson, and those end up in the top 20 playwrights list. So it just gives data is just a way to look at the numbers. These lists are a way to organize it and sort it, and hopefully the picture will start to change. It seems to be in that direction, right?
Well, considering how many theaters in the upcoming season are doing seasons that are half or predominantly or all female seasons,
yeah,
and making quite a big deal of it in their press releases and pointing it out, that I think people are aware that it is an issue, and they are.
Well, there's also the feedback to people making such a big deal about their women-led seasons or their big women's-only festivals that they're tokenizing women. And then it's not 50% of the U.S. experience.
Well, no.
Yeah, but then...
Or tokenizing the female experience.
But then what do we call affirmative action?
Right. I mean, look, the rallying cry years ago was 50-50 by 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's a quota, but I think if the goal is parity, you can't avoid the numbers that you're going for. I just think it's about being conscious and looking at whether your season and your stages and your audiences reflect the demographic of the region you serve.
But like, what if one season it's like 70% female and one season it's like 40%, and it just varies based on the programming. It's not like a 50.
Right.
Every year.
Yeah. I it would be nice if that were a problem we had. I mean, so that we could, you know. So that we could look at the aggregate, but right now it's just, it's much more likely to be the other, you know, 70-30 male.
Yeah.
Or all male.
It's harder for the theaters that only program classic.
It is harder for them. It's also, I mean, for some theaters in some regions, their audience is predominantly Caucasian and their talent pool, but that's
they can still program females in that, that region.
Audience is predominantly female.
That's
all
true.
Around for all theaters.
Yeah, scratch that. I'm conflating those issues.
It's hard not to.
Yeah.
Because there's lack of representation all around.
This is true.
I mean, as Lisa Crone so eloquently says, we need lots of different types of people telling the story of the world.
Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need tokens.
Yeah.
It's a great segue to talk about the Wild Party. Now, Encore's Off Center, just briefly, is a spin-off of City Center's Encore series, where Encore's revives Broadway shows. That's been their mission from the start. Chicago, the current hit on Broadway, grew from an encore staging. And there have been others that have gone on to Broadway staging. In fact, one of them went on to Broadway staging was this Encore's Off-Center series, which is intended for shows that were either off-Broadway or in some other way alternative. They would not make the cut for the Encore season. So this is a summer season of three shows. They've done things like Randy Newman's Faust, which didn't even play in New York before. It was at La Jolla and Goodman. A couple years ago, the person who founded this, Janine Tesori, her musical Violet, which had a short run at the Playwrights Horizons, then became a popular musical around the country, had its Encore staging and then went to Broadway starring Sutton Foster. So this summer, one of the things she revived that I wish I'd seen was Little Shop of Horrors with Ellen Green, the original Audrey. Did any of you see that? That sounded like
it was impossible to get tickets. It was one night only.
Yeah.
Two nights only,
yeah. I wish I'd seen that. That sounded amazing. What I did see instead was one of the Wild Parties.
Because there's so many.
15 years ago, there was that weird coincidence where this public domain poem from the 20s that was published in New Yorker was reissued in this edition by Art Spiegelman with these cool, lurid illustrations. And since it was public domain, two bright musical theater makers thought, this would make a great musical. So they both did. Michael John Lacusa, his was at the Public. Andrew Lippa, his was at Manhattan Theater Club. And they opened in the same season. And the partisans have divided over the years over which one was better. Lacusa's went to Broadway briefly with Mandy Patinkin and Eartha Kitt and Toni Collette. Didn't get great reviews. Lippa's just stayed at MTC, and I think it closed early even.
Yeah, it had Julia Murney, Brian D'Arcy James,
Taye Diggs,
Adina Menzel.
And that one, that both of them have their cult followings. I went in there. I love Sutton Foster. I could not make it past the first act. It wasn't my favorite. It's not my kind of music. That kind of show tune-y.
It was not even show tune. It was like kind of pop, contemporary, and anachronistic.
I loved the music.
Oh, no. I'm nothing against that. Yeah. It was definitely a myriad of different musical influences.
It felt show tune-y to me. Just to choose to open this, a musical about this really dark, weird, sexy party with a wild, wild party. Like, that opening number, it was started low and it was downhill.
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, I didn't see the show and didn't know it before I saw it, but after seeing the show, I went and listened to the cast album because I had heard Andrew Lippa was doing a bunch of rewrites for this offset staging.
I heard that, yeah, yeah.
And the original opening number is actually kind of a down and dirty song called Queenie Was a Blonde about kind of explaining everything that you missed.
Well, that's
the
opening
staging.
Of the poem. The poem was the Queenie sang two nights in vaudeville.
Yeah, and it's a gorgeous song. And I'm kind of like, why did they cut this song?
They wanted Happy Sutton Foster to open the show.
When freaking Stephen Pasquale comes out with a clown nose on, I just thought, what am I watching? Why? And the show did not get much better. There were some moments where it really... And it's true, Andrew Lippa uses sort of pop stylings and that electric guitar. But none of that worked for me either.
The electric guitar was more of a crime in the cast album, though. They toned it down for this production.
Okay.
I liked that it was mostly sung through. I didn't expect that from an Andrew Lippa musical. And it was really nice that it was basically kind of like a mini opera type thing. I mean, there was a book, but it was a lot of singing.
So did people die in the second act? I missed.
Spoiler alert.
Did people get shot?
Spoiler alert. In the second act... Burrs catches Queenie with Mr. Black, and he gets really mad with a gun, and there's a whole song with Burrs with a gun, and then they get into a wrestling match with the gun, and oops, somebody gets shot, and it's not Mr. Black, it's Burrs, and then Queenie lets Black run and decides to turn herself in.
Wow.
So you missed a big fight because your size
was
early.
That the whole show was leading to
open
the first
act,
scene.
The second act opener is one of the famous song that Adina Menzel did off Broadway. Mm-hmm. That Kate sings the
life.
Don't you want to be the life of the party? That's the song everybody knows from the show,
which was pretty.
That girl who played Kate was amazing.
She was great. The cast was great. I just
there was a really funny
That freaking lesbian love story song, which was
that was like the best thing about that show.
Are you serious?
Well,
would have been funny about 20 years ago at a cabaret. That feels like, really? We're laughing at that? That just didn't find
No, it wasn't even the fact that we were laughing at it.
Miriam Shore was great, but I felt that...
That was the one time in the show where there was actually a little bit of nuance, a little bit of tongue-in-cheek.
There was levity in that moment.
That's true.
It wasn't even levity. It was the fact that the rest of the musical, there was no real.
Oh, do you think Two of a Kind, that hilarious number with the Mutt and Jeff couple? God, I can't take that kind of music. I just can't take it.
My problem with Miriam Shore is I didn't know why she was in the story.
Well, there's that too.
It was random,
but I thought she was great, and I thought the song was fun.
Yeah, I didn't like it so much. Allison, we want to put you on the spot, but you're sort of new to the podcast.
And you saw it.
I did see it. I think I was just more... This was my first Encores experience. This is my first time at New York City Center. So I was just kind of like excited just to be there.
Yeah, yeah.
I was a gracious audience. Something was great.
Yeah.
But I went to the lobby party before, too, which kind of sets the mood, which was fun. They had this jazz band out.
Nice.
And then Janine Tesori kind of hosted a dance party. So
should have gone to that.
So that kind of set the mood. But I don't know. I wasn't familiar with the music before, so right. I really enjoyed it. But some of these points are valid here.
Your entitled enjoyment.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's fun, but I just don't understand it as material that is worthy of not one but two musical adaptations. Because why do we give a shit about these characters? Not really compelling characters. It's not like Chicago where they're horrible but interesting with personality. They're just horrible people. It's like, why am I having a party with these people? I don't want to go to their party.
Why is it 2 acts? Like, it could be a 90-minute show.
Yeah. It just didn't feel like a very wild party to me. That's my.
But I have a question about the casting, just because I know. I mean, Kevin McCollum has money in the show, and Andrew Glipper rewrote a lot of the songs for this. So obviously, they're probably eyeing some sort of a transfer for it.
Like, it needs more pathos. It just needs some pain.
But are these actors the right age to play these characters?
They're miscast.
They're all too old. Mm-hmm. Someone I went to with was talking about how the girl who played Kate, who was probably the most age appropriate, was too young, and I was like, no, she's the only one that's the right age. Everyone else
is. Well,
I think
it was Eartha Kitt originally in the Melucusa version.
Well, I mean, it was Brian D'Arcy James and Julia Murney off Broadway, and I think Sutton and Stephen Pasquale are probably around the same age range as they are, and they're doing it now.
Unless you want to go with the whole, these are people who are in the twilight, not twilight, but they're not young and sexy anymore, and they're trying to be relevant.
Yeah, but that's a different take on the story.
Yeah.
Did Lippa do the book? Because, like, that adaptation might have been part of the problem.
Yeah, Lippa did the book, but there was hardly any book.
Yeah, mm-hmm. There you go. I mean, to me, I didn't know why we were watching it, and I didn't like the way it was told. Other than that, great. You know, one thing interesting about Encores is, you know, I didn't notice the books in hand until about halfway through the first act, and Encores has gotten really elaborate so that the productions are, like... productions like this is all
they do like a slick little way of hiding the book because the first night I went the first night on Wednesday and Sutton was holding the book like she would hold a tray.
Nobody had a book when I went.
Sutton held it
had a book when I went.
When'd Saturday? You go?
I went to the Saturday night.
I went Saturday matinee.
They all had books.
Where did I didn't see any books.
They were very subtle about it, but they were carrying books around.
Like during the party, and they'd carry them casually, like you were carrying drinks.
I noticed zero books.
I saw one book, and I thought Sutton was holding a guest list, because she was holding it in a way as she would look at it as they all came through the door, and I was like, oh, like, I had no idea.
Well, they've worked it into the staging, and they've got choreography, they've got whole dance numbers.
Yeah, costumes, wigs, Sutton in a platinum blonde wig. I think she should be blonde all the time.
There were no books at the New Brain when I saw a New Brain. I don't know.
Wow.
They hide the books.
They hide
but
them
by equity well. Contracts, they have to be able to use their books, because it's such a short rehearsal period.
Right, right. I mean, I think there's also a psychological thing that if you use the books there, that's a good crutch that they're, you know.
Well, they only have 6 days to, like, rehearse it.
But, like, Stephen Pasquale, during any of the musical numbers, none of them had books.
No, he didn't have, for the big numbers, they didn't. But definitely some of the recitative-type stuff, I saw them walking around with their books.
Yeah, there's also full-blown choreography, too. Like, they had
a full-blown set, costumes.
Yeah.
When I saw Merrily We Roll along there, like two, 3 years ago.
That was
ago,
a full production.
They were books, but they had books. And music stands.
Yeah, when I saw Cradle Will Rock with Raul Esparza, there was music stands and everyone was in black.
That was staged as a reading. That was self-consciously Sam Gold trying to make it look like a reading.
Not it didn't add anything to the production.
Not a total success.
Well, Merrily Roll Along was a full production. And Celia Keane Boulder had her book like this the whole time, like on her arm.
Susie just cradled the book.
Yes, I just mimicked holding a book while gesturing with one hand at a cocktail party as Marion.
How about Tick, Tick, Boom?
Did
I have books or no?
They did have books, but Lynn knew all the words, obviously, because he's like a Jonathan super fan.
I think that's a great segue to our interview with Susan Booth, the Alliance Theater, where a lot of new plays are developed, including some Broadway-bound ones. She has one coming this season, right?
Yeah, this spring. This past January or February, I can't quite remember, they did an adaptation of Tuck Everlasting.
Right.
Susie, you know more about Broadway-bound stuff than I do.
Casey Nicholas directing
it. Casey Nicholas directing it. It's taking over the Broadhurst, which is where Mamma Mia is. So Mamma Mia is heading toward Broadway. Tuck Everlasting is coming in. I mean, it kind of has, like, it was supposed to be up in Boston, I think, and then it was at the Alliance.
Yeah.
This is the Alliance's first Broadway transfer.
Yeah. Starring Andrew Keenan Bolger.
And Carolee Carmello, I might be
Who
lying.
Who wrote it?
Nathan Tyson did the lyrics.
So this is their first one. Over the years, they've done a lot of things that they hope to go to Broadway.
Yeah, like
Ghost Brothers of Darlington County. Now, Bring It On eventually made it to Broadway by way of the Amundsen. So that wasn't quite an Alliance-launched piece. Anyway, that's not the only measure of a theater's success, as Darko Treznak will tell you. why don't we go to your interview with Susan Booth, Deep?
So I'm sitting down today with Susan Booth, who is the Jennings Hertz Artistic Director of the Alliance Theater. First of all, can I ask, where did that title
come
from? Yeah.
A really remarkable man, Jennings Hertz, who was actually on the search committee that brought me to the Alliance a bunch of years ago. He came to the theater about 4 years before he passed away. And made the observation that some years he loved what I produced and some years he didn't. And he made very handsomely generous annual gifts to the theater. But as he said, I'm getting older, I'm getting cranky, and the worst thing that could ever happen is that I second guess my own philanthropic impulse. And I decide one year, I didn't like last year's season, I'm not going to give her a gift this year. So to prevent that, I'm going to give you a big endowment that spins off the amount of what my annual gifts have been. And he wanted that to be the end of the conversation, but his children came to me and said, we would like to name your position in honor of our father and his support of the theater. And I was delighted. Because if you're really, really lucky, you have those kind of donors that he was a board member, he was a donor, but most importantly, he was a really dear friend. So
he will be at the theater forever.
Exactly.
Yeah, in a way.
Exactly.
Yeah. So whenever you introduce yourself, do you say the full title or do you
In Atlanta, I certainly, with great pride, introduce myself as the Jennings Hertz Artistic Director because his son is currently the chairman of the board of the Art Center. The Woodruff Art Center, which is where the Alliance Theater is housed. It's a family whose cultural philanthropy is really well known, and I love associating my work with his name. Outside of Atlanta, I usually just go by Artistic. I usually just go by Susan.
Okay, good. Whenever we write things up about the Alliance for American Theater, we always have to double-check the name to make sure we get it correct.
Well, for a long time, his legal given name was Jennings Hertz Jr. And in an interview, someone asked me, absolutely without irony, they introduced me at the beginning of the interview, as you did, as the Jennings Hertz Jr. Artistic Director, and they asked me without irony when I anticipated becoming a Senior Artistic Director. So I went to the family and said, would you be okay if we dropped the Jr.?
And everyone needs to know that you're the big.
Now, I've made it to the seniors.
Since we're talking about cheerleading plays before this thing got started, can you tell our listeners what is the scene of Atlanta Theater?
You're the only Lord House now.
Sadly, we are. Yeah. Up until a year and a half ago, the Georgia Shakespeare Festival was the other Lord Theater in town. The really good news is that there are fantastic small and mid-sized companies with an incredibly broad range of aesthetics and missions.
Mm-hmm.
We have Seven Stages that works in experimental international forms. We have Horizon Theater that brings a lot of well-known work to Atlanta. We have Actors Express, which, as the name would imply, is a very actor-first aesthetic theatrical outfit, the Aurora Stage, Synchronicity. There's a really vast community of arts makers. What I love is it's also the center, the home of the Center for Puppetry Arts,
mm-hmm.
which is probably the foremost artistic home for puppetry arts in the country.
Right.
It is also the home of the Center for Civil and Human Rights, and that is a center that's opened relatively recently, but that is very aware of the role that performance and music and visual arts played in the evolution of the human rights movement. So in a lot of ways, we are a wildly idiosyncratic cultural community.
Yeah. It seems like there's all kinds of types of theaters, from like small fringe stuff to mid-size to Lord-size theaters.
There absolutely is.
Yeah. But since you've been in the position since 91, when did all this crop up?
I've actually only been there since 2001.
Oh, goodness. Sorry.
Quite all right.
Yeah.
You know, it was a robust community
mm-hmm.
when I got there.
Mm-hmm.
I think the change that I've seen in my 14 years there
mm-hmm.
has been a larger adoption by the civic community and the corporate community of the cultural community as a partner,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to a philanthropic bucket that needed to be filled. We're actually perceived as means to an end.
Yeah.
And that's kind of fantastic, because
mm-hmm.
that's really what any cultural community ought to be anywhere.
Yeah. So it's like a high value on theater going, and
there's a high value on what theater and performance can do to accomplish the larger goal of a compassionate and inclusive community.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We, at the Alliance particularly, we don't make theater to make theater. That is not the end game for us.
Right.
We are interested in expanding hearts and minds, and we do that on stage and off stage.
Right.
And we do that through a deeply rigorous cradle-to-grave educational engagement program. We do that through a commitment to inclusivity writ large in our audience and our staff and our work.
And it seems like just the things that you program, from children's theater to new plays to big glitzy musicals, there's like a wide array of topics. And so I guess when you're programming a season, do you actively look for diversity, or is it just the best things that come to your desk?
We look for work that allows diversity to happen. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I came from the Goodman, and I was the director of new projects there. And when I started at the Alliance, I produced and directed new plays sort of out of habit, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to say it was deeply intentional. It wasn't. It was habitual. But what I discovered the longer I spent in Atlanta was that producing new work is the ultimate leveling of the playing field. If I produce a fantastic production of Peer Gynt, right? First of all, I will never produce Peer Gynt. The Ibsen folks can come find me. Let's say I did. So some parallel universe I did. Before the lights ever come up, there's a lack of parity, right? Because
mm-hmm.
that guy down there did his doctorate on Ibsen, and that guy actually saw that fantastic production at the National last year. And this person who's at the theater for the very first time doesn't even know what Peer Gynt means and who's this Ibsen guy. And so before the play ever starts, there is this disparity.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when we do a world premiere, particularly, everybody's meeting it for the first time together.
Right.
And so there's a leveling, and there's a the only thing that gets privileged is the life experience of each person in the audience,
okay,
because that's what's going to inform the next step narrative of that new play. So we do a lot of new work. We do work. We have a show running right now called Blub Blub, and Blub Blub is a environmental experiential piece that was designed for 0 to 2 year olds, and it is a immersive gallery that's mm-hmm. been created through objects and light and sound to feel as if it's completely underwater.
Right.
We have these littles come in, and we, with their parents' permission, we put little shark fins on their backs, and they are actually part of the performance.
Do they get to keep the shark costumes?
They do get to walk away with their shark fins.
Yes!
And actors in various undersea costumes interact with them, and they create their own language for the 40 minutes or so of performance. But we can seem wildly schizophrenic. There is always a common denominator, which is everything we do has to have as many open doors and windows as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we figure out if something's an alliance project. Can anyone from anywhere find a way in?
Right.
Because if
right.
there is a prerequisite that you need,
mm-hmm.
that's not for us.
Right. And immersive theater, I'm just a big fan of immersive theater in general,
right.
but I can't believe it's been very recently that theaters discovered, oh, immersive theater is perfect for young kids.
Oh my gosh, we have this Theater for the Very Young program that we're in our fifth year of, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Everything we do in there is world premiere commissioned. We take artists, sometimes we'll take an extant text and ask an artist to blow it up. But everything that we do in there is brand new, and everything is completely immersive. And we work with linguistic development scholars to figure out what are the tropes. How many times do you have to repeat something before an 18-month-old early learner will repeat it the sixth time with you, right? And all of these projects up through the fifth year of development are based on literacy development models. But
mm-hmm.
they don't know that. They just know that they get to put a shark fin on their back and be in this really cool spot that looks like their fish tank. One of the first ones that we did was a piece called Waiting for Balloon.
I heard about that.
Waiting for Balloon was really cool. It was Godot for 3 and 4 year olds. And it was fantastic. Completely immersive.
Did the balloon ever arrive?
That would ruin the story. That would have to do a spoiler alert.
I mean, if I was a 3-year-old, I'd feel very upset. The balloon didn't arrive.
I'll ruin it for everyone. The balloon arrived.
Great. I loved what you just said about new work, because I have admitted many times to Twitter that I enjoy new work a lot more than I enjoy classics.
Right.
And I don't know if that's something that you're allowed to say.
You know, that's so funny because I came to theater out of academia. My
mm-hmm.
last year in a doctoral program, I was assigned as a highfalutin fellow at a theater.
Where'd you go to?
I was at Northwestern.
Oh.
And I got assigned through the Kemper Foundation, had this amazing fellowship program, and I got assigned to Northlight Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And here I am, the ostensible resident egghead, right? I never enjoyed classics. Now, that had everything to do with the productions of classics
that I
participated in and that I saw as an audience member. And it was heretical, right? Because that's the canon. That's the roots that we all grow from, right? But I didn't find room for the conversations I was interested in having as a young woman
mm-hmm.
in those texts. Now, again, I didn't find them in the productions of those texts that I was meeting.
Right.
I find myself and a whole lot of other people very ably reflected in Fiasco's productions, in Mihai's productions,
yeah.
right? Explosions of canonical work. But for me, because of when I started making theater, new work all the way.
Right, right. Is it because, I mean, there aren't that many female written classic works?
Well, but right there, I mean, yes, and there are, but we don't
do them.
You know, who's out there doing Rachel Crothers? Who's out there doing Susan Glasspool? You know, who's out there doing the Afro Ben Festival?
Oh, yes,
right?
Yes.
We talk a lot at my theater about who sits at the leadership table.
Mm-hmm.
You can diversify your programming. You can diversify your audience, right? You can live in a radically diverse community. Who's at your leadership table and who's making the decisions?
Mm-hmm.
And the equivalency being who were the editors of great plays of the English language, right? Who invested these texts with their authority?
Right.
And these texts often have profoundly great bones, but who's connecting them to a contemporary audience and how?
Mm-hmm.
At the Goodman, we had a kind of house aesthetic. You just, nobody sat you down and taught it to you. You just absorbed it and knew it as a director, which was that you treat classical work with the muscular investigation typically accorded premieres,
mm-hmm.
and you treat premieres with the respect and authority typically accorded canonical work.
Right.
And if that was your approach as a director, you made sweaty, vibrant, immediate classical work, and you made premieres with great bones. And I did most of my growing up as an artist and a director at a particular time in the Goodman's history, and I'm dead grateful for it because it leveled the idea of classic and new work in a useful way.
Right, right. You can't approach it reverentially or well, what are we all doing here?
Boring,
I know.
I have a friend, Ken Cash, who was my associate at the Alliance for a long time, who I adore, he came to the Alliance from the Alabama Shakespeare Festival.
Oh, I love them.
And in our first few conversations, I said, okay, well, I'm not sure how I feel about the classics. And he said, okay, first of all, if you're thinking about Pumpkin Pants, Foot on the Barrel declaiming, then that's not what I do. And I always think about that phrase, Pumpkin Pants, Foot on the Barrel.
Is that what they call those pants?
You know, those.
Yeah, yeah, yes, the Elizabethan, really
giant. You oldie, tiny, we're going to declaim now in a quasi-British
British man.
Even though we're not from there. Yeah.
I do love Fiasco, too. I think it's a youthful energy.
I think it's a youthful energy, and I also think every text should be looked at as a fantastic first time ever followed map, right?
Right, right.
And you know how, you're probably too young to remember these, but they you can still find them sometimes. Those You Are Here maps,
mm-hmm.
like at shopping malls and things.
Right.
Right, big red arrow, You Are Here. So I love that idea, right? Because every play begins with a collection of people who are where they are.
Mm-hmm.
And the audience is where they are.
Right.
And if you don't pay attention to that, then this is museum work. This isn't theater. And what I love about Fiasco is so clearly the artists are where they are. They're meeting the audience where the audience is.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels absolutely written yesterday immediately.
Right.
How about that?
Yeah. One of the programs that I really like at the Alliance, even though I've never been there, is the Candida? Yeah, the Candida, Alliance Candida graduate playwriting competition.
Yeah.
Just because there's so many playwrights whose work that you premiere, and then I see them produced elsewhere, like
right.
Meg Borashnik and
right.
Kenneth, you know,
Ken Lynn.
And
Jerome McCraney was one of our early winners, and Mike Liu. Mike
mm-hmm.
Liu, who this is
Bike America. Yeah.
Bike America was the winner probably about 4 years ago, and we
mm-hmm.
are premiering his newest, Tiger Style, on our big stage this fall.
You know, one of our editors saw a reading of it, and she loved it. So I'm excited to see what happens.
What I love about Tiger Style is, while it is absolutely a specific cultural story, it is so radically resistant to being only that cultural story. Mm-hmm. It's about brothers and sisters. It's about parents and children. It's about unrealistic expectations that our parents have of us that we're going to just tank miserably and fail at.
Yeah.
And it completely just disintegrates any notion of Asian as other, right?
Right.
Because you sit, I mean, we did a reading recently, and this audience of everything in the world was sitting, and every single one of us had been skewered by our mother in the way that Mike has his character get skewered by his mother.
What's it about? Is it autobiographical?
that's between you and Mike Liu.
I'll tweet at him. I will find that out.
It is a pair of Chinese-American siblings who are, mm-hmm. on paper, absolute perfection, right? The surgeon who was a concert pianist. The software designer who was an amazing cellist, right? But they're both without any emotional skills, and they're so unhappy. And they decide that it is their parents' tiger parenting that is completely at fault. They have no skin in the game themselves, right. And they're going to take it up to their parents.
Considering Tiger Moms, it seems to be that Asian trope. I'm hoping that he disassembles that.
He completely disassembles that. He completely disassembles that. Agency is agency, right?
Yeah.
You take it or you don't.
Right.
And everybody has tried to palm off their own mistakes on their parents. Right. Nobody's got a lock on that.
Yeah, from Eugene O'Neill onwards.
There you go. Back to the classic.
Do we consider... Well, wait, I had this conversation in the office.
What do you consider a classic?
Yeah,
how dead do they have to be?
When do we consider it a contemporary work?
You know, I had a teacher once who completely aligned that with when something moved into public domain automatically. It was like 75 years, really.
Yeah, 70
it.
Years.
70 years and boom, you're a classic? You know, I think that's a great question. I think anything that can be made evergreen, I'm perfectly happy to call a classic, right?
Mm-hmm.
But just because, you know, there's a bust of that dead white guy somewhere does not seem sufficient rationale for the title. When I started working at the Goodman, we were in the old Goodman Theater, which was in the, mm-hmm. Art Institute in Chicago. And the main auditorium had up at the top these alcoves with these busts of all the dead white guys. And the first play that I ever directed on that stage with the busts of all the dead white guys was Regina Taylor's Oobly-Doo.
Yes! Take that!
Dead white guys!
And one of these days, they'll put a bust of Regina Taylor up on that wall, and it will be fantastic.
That would be a thing of beauty. I love that. That'd be cool.
Yeah. Something that I'm curious about when you do the graduating playwright competitions is, how do you pick that hot new playwright that's
so
freshly graduated or not even
really
graduated?
Cool, and bless you for asking that question, because it's just a fact worth noting.
Mm-hmm.
It is a completely blind submission policy.
Okay.
All right. We don't know name. We don't know school. We know nothing but the title of the text.
And they have to still be a student.
They have to be in their final year of graduate, mm-hmm. work. They submit one play.
Mm-hmm.
Every single play that comes in gets three readings. A short list is formed, and that short list becomes the finalists.
Mm-hmm.
All five finalists have readings and workshops in New York and Atlanta. The winning play gets developed at the Kennedy Center, as well as has its world premiere with us. But back to the blind submission part, because this is cool.
Yeah.
We are now in our 12th year.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about 60 young writers who have been identified as finalists, inclusive of the winner. And the percentage of writers of color and women, 90.
Oh, my God.
Blind submission.
There goes a pipeline.
Right? Right? So, you know, the first artistic director I ever worked for, it was real simple.
Mm-hmm.
It's a meritocracy, right?
Of course.
Of course. Given, right? And to go back to where we started, so I've been to a bunch of these conferences.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been a bunch of conversations over the years.
TCG conferences.
Yeah. It should be such a given, right? Meritocracy. Meritocracy. Mm-hmm. But society has screwed with that idea. And we're kidding ourselves if we don't acknowledge the means to the platform where your merit can be seen.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what skews the deal. But it's a blind submission policy. Any kid can enter, and those are the outcomes.
Right. I had this conversation with another director about how theater is in itself a field where you need to come from some means of, like, some privilege. Now, I want to say privilege because it's a loaded word, but like some, it's like a comfortable means in order to make a living.
I'll get to that
place of executive leadership.
It's absolutely true. And I'm an older mom of a young kid, and I took her first grade class, brought the first grade class to come see a show at the theater. She's in a public school, and a bunch of us show up because we can't, the school's not going to provide us with a bus. A bunch
mm-hmm.
of us show up, bunch of moms, and a mom of one of my kids' classmates says, "What made you think to do this? This is such a neat idea." This is a woman who's probably 30,
mm-hmm.
who herself had never been to theater. This was a person of not insignificant means.
Mm-hmm.
It was never in her practice. It wasn't something her parents did. It's
mm-hmm.
no longer in our school. And it simply wasn't something that she did. And she's now raising a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it was this sort of jaw-dropping moment of, it has become associated with privilege.
Right.
It has been, the practice has been, the exposure has been eradicated from so many of our schools. And even if you just make the division of public and private, automatically, you're in a class discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Who's getting access to it? Who isn't?
Right.
I mean, it's all kinds of complicated.
Yeah, and who gets to be in drama club?
You know the exercise? Yeah. High school teacher, he's got 30 kids, right? Five
mm-hmm.
kids per row in six rows.
Mm-hmm.
And he puts a wastebasket under the chalkboard at the front of the classroom. He says, "Everybody take out a piece of paper. Crumple it up into a ball. All right. Anybody who makes a basket gets a free A on the next assignment. You just have to shoot from your seat."
Okay.
Everybody shoots. Front row, everybody makes it. Second row, most people make it. Back row, nobody makes it except this one kid who happens to have like a naturally mad skill, right?
That would not have been me.
Well, they finish this.
Yeah.
And the teacher says, "Okay," you know, he notes down who got the free A, who didn't. And he said, "Was that fair? Kids in the front row? Totally. Kids in the back row? Absolutely not. Kids in the front row, turn around. Okay, the kids in the back row are a whole lot further away from the basket, right?"
Mm-hmm.
And they say, "Yeah, but that one kid did it. So it's not unfair." And there you have it. There you have privilege in our country. There you have received racism in our country. There
mm-hmm.
you have bias in our country. And the absolute lack of awareness that I got born into the front row by dint of the color of my skin. How often do I think about that? I think, "Hey, I made the basket. Meritocracy. Yay me."
Mm-hmm.
Right? How often do I think about that? And the kid in the back row didn't do anything wrong. That's just where they started. We're getting the same lesson. We didn't start from the same place.
No.
Yeah. So.
No. I'm going to use that in the future whenever I have to explain privilege.
It's a great exercise.
Yeah, it is a great exercise.
It's a totally great exercise. And it's we're in a kind of constant conversation because I live in Atlanta, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
We're in a pretty constant conversation about this with the work that we make, with the people in our audience, with the people around our leadership table.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be. It's so easy to be stupid.
Or to go with the status quo. of whoever happens to be submitting right. plays to your season.
Right.
So when you have, I don't want to name anybody, but when you have people who say, I picked the best plays,
right.
and I don't really,
yep.
I'm not aware of
yep.
race, gender,
yep.
how do you respond to that?
Well, who knew where you were? Who knew mm-hmm. how to get their play in front of you? How hard did you work to, I picked the best plays? Well, how many do you read? And where do you go to get them? Right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm really proud of the statistics on the National Graduate Playwriting Competition. I'm also very mindful that not every kid gets to go to grad school.
Right.
Right. Now, a whole lot of the kids that have won over the years, okay, they've been there on merit scholarship, need scholarship, and I can sort of mollify my queasiness around that. But what else are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
Right. We also have a summer program where 20 kids from all over the region come together and they, working with a professional writer and a professional director, they take a extant text, even a classic text,
wow.
and they blow it up and they rewrite it as shot through the prism of their own experience.
Mm-hmm.
And those kids economically come from all over the map, right? And they write a piece that they perform the first draft of it. The professional writer takes it away and comes back with a version for a small cast that's done by professional actors. And again, the playing field's pretty level,
mm-hmm.
right? Everybody in that room is equal skin in the game as a creator. And they learn something about writing.
Right.
But I don't know that Nobody walks around without bias. I just pick the best players. I pick the best players. Okay, where'd they come from? Where did your own standards of best come from?
Right.
And it's not to say we're all, you said this was informal, right?
Yes.
It's not to say we're all totally fucked, right? but we do ourselves and any kind of advancement a profound disservice if we don't acknowledge the biases we carry around.
Right, right.
And back to the kids trying to make, you know, the basket. What happened before we ever showed up that put us in the front row or put us in the back row? You know, it's worth paying attention to.
Right. Wait, so in the exercise where they rewrote classics, who's been the most memorable one for you?
Okay, so my favorite one.
Yeah.
We did... because we're at Southern Theater, we did Glass Menagerie a few years ago. And there was a scene that they created, which were mm-hmm. All the Facebook pages of Laura. It was Amanda's Facebook page for Laura, Tom, the Gentleman Callers, and then Laura's Facebook page. It was brilliant. And if you think about it, is that not the play? Right?
It's the play.
It was brilliant. Best ever. All right, I have to go to this 2:30.
Okay. Oh, my goodness. I had one more thing I wanted
right,
to ask you about.
Ask.
Yeah, yeah.
Ask.
So I read up the statistics about leadership,
yep.
and it's about 27% women. So
right.
how do you open up?
You mentor.
Yeah.
And you do it thoughtfully. You do it intentionally. You don't just sort of hope it happens. If you see a glimpse of something in someone,
mm-hmm.
Put them in a position of authority. And let them fail. And let them fail more than once.
Right.
Make sure they're learning from their failures. Make sure that they're aware of them. And make sure that your definition of failure might in fact be the problem. You know, maybe they're
right.
evolving. maybe your standards aren't all that anymore. But I think it's pretty critical.
Mm-hmm.
My husband likes to refer to the Alliance Theater as the femdom. Theater because of its feminine domination. We've got a
sounds kind of kinky, just a little bit.
Femdom. That's
yes.
it. That's it. But we've got a lot of women in leadership positions. Because really, how would we succeed if we didn't?
Right. Yeah, and don't let the failures of women be an indicative of failures of
no. I mean, it's,
all
it's,
women.
My maybe it's by dint of age, but my current enthusiasm, and it's
mm-hmm.
a big one. Is the profound power and gift of good failure.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean,
right.
Edison tried about 10,000 times before one of those light bulbs worked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's baked into our art form.
Yeah.
We draft, we redraft. We do set models. What's a rehearsal? It's a systematic period of failure.
Right.
On your way to discovering something.
Yeah.
So useful.
And not all productions succeed either.
Oh, no.
Yeah,
no.
So you can't be afraid of that.
Yeah, not at all.
All right, I'm going to let you go, but thank you so much for talking to us.
It is my pleasure.
And we're back with some recommendations / things to talk about. Allison, do you have something that you want to recommend that you've seen, that you've read?
I do have something.
Yeah.
I saw a play at the Fresh Fruit Festival last week, and it was called Mary Todd, the play.
Okay.
And unfortunately, its run is over, but hopefully it'll have another life. It's this former sex worker named Todd Lincoln. His boyfriend is murdered, and it's this one-man show, and he goes through therapy and past life regression workshops and decides that he is the reincarnation of Mary Todd Lincoln. And so he parallels his boyfriend's assassination with the life of Mary Todd. And it's pretty incredible.
Who's it by?
Dennis Bush.
Okay. Wow.
So keep a lookout for that.
What is the Fresh Fruit Festival? Where is that?
It takes place at the Wild Project
in
the East Village.
Wow.
What kind of place?
They're mainly focused on LGBT.
Hence the Fresh Fruit name?
Fresh Fruit.
Clever.
Oh, okay. I just got that right now. Oh, that's... Okay, reclaiming that.
Yeah.
I can support that. Okay.
So, Deep, what do you have for us? They're going alphabetically.
Okay.
Thank you, Allison.
I saw Manual Cinema's Ada/Ava at 3LD, Three-Legged Dog, down in Lower Manhattan. And Manual Cinema is a Chicago-based company. They do shadow puppetry.
Mm-hmm.
And the one that I saw, it's an hour-long show with music, and it's about two older sisters, one of whom dies. They're twins, and it's about loss and grief and, you know, trying to figure out, like, how to be alone after being with someone for your entire life.
Right. But it's staged in a really fascinating way, right?
Yeah, it is. They use these old school projections that you used to use in, you know, in elementary school to, like, do math problems.
Yeah, yeah.
And they line up four projections, and they put the puppets on four of them, and...
Like transparency projectors?
Maybe? Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Oh, I love those things, yeah.
Yeah, but the way they do it, I can't even describe it. Like, they can make, like, a cinematic effect with those projections. Mm-hmm. So sceneries move, there's lightning, there's actual lightning that comes into the scene,
right.
and there are things like clocks ticking, or like, and they also have the two actresses that play the sisters, they have them in a screen in front of the projectors,
okay.
And they're acting out the scenes with the giant projected images behind them.
Sounds awesome. There was a description.
It's really complex. I'm not doing it justice to how I'm describing it.
Well, yeah, there's a description in the... It was they were one of the people featured, one of the groups featured in our recent puppet story by, I forget the guy's name, but it was a wonderful piece. Scott Cummings.
Yeah.
Was it Scott Cummings? Do I have that right?
Yeah. You're right.
Wonderful feature about... And even just describing his puppetry didn't sound like it. He was saying it didn't really do justice to what they do. Yes, they use puppets, but they use all these other elements of theater, live actors.
It's like War Horse.
It's like
live musicians
film.
To like provide background noise and live sound effects. And so you can see them do all of this. And so I was so enamored with just watching them do the process sometimes, I completely forgot that I was supposed to be watching a story on the screen.
Right.
So that show is running until this weekend of 26, and then they're going back to Chicago. So for Chicago people, if you have not seen a Manual Cinema show and you don't know if you like shadow puppetry, they will get you into shadow puppetry.
Sounds good. I don't have recommendations. I have sort of a pet theory I wanted to try out and see if anyone out there in the podcast world can fill me in about this / tell me I'm wrong. I was just thinking about, we've been talking about with Spring Awakening, the deaf hearing version coming to Broadway soon, about deaf culture and plays that feature deaf subjects. And when Children of a Lesser God is going to come back to Broadway, and it was just, you know, the director was immediately asked, you're going to cast a deaf actress, like, of course we are. That is, it's just no question. When the play Tribes, which is one of the top 10 most produced plays last season, I think,
mm-hmm.
which has a major deaf character in it, has been cast around the country. Now, I haven't documented this, but it seems to me that in every place it's done, it's cast a deaf or hard of hearing actor in the lead role. It seems to me that the culture of a play is created by the original production in a way with not only deaf actors, but I was thinking actually in terms of Asian actors as well. One of the reasons King and I has had so much trouble over the decades, I would just posit, with casting appropriately, is that the original cast was not, the King was barely Asian. Yul Brynner, like, you could claim like a tiny bit of
Mongolian.
Right, exactly. So, whereas something like Flower Drum Song, which has its own problems, but that was cast intentionally with all Asian Americans in the 50s, and you just would never hear of a production of Flower Drum Song. It just wouldn't be done with white actors in yellow face. This is just a theory I'm trying out, because it seems to me that Miracle Worker was a play about Helen Keller, and I'm sure there have been productions in which there have been deaf and or blind, or deaf and blind, or hard of hearing actors, cast, or otherwise disabled. But because the culture of that was this bravura acting performance, that was the play, the film, that is regularly cast with non-disabled actors. This is just a theory I'm trying out. It feels like the casting is important, and it's important that we look at these classic plays with minority and disabled actors and try to recast them. But the way they're originally cast seems to have a huge influence. So I guess it's sort of I'm positing this. Please tell me if I'm wrong or if I'm full of it. Come to our Facebook page.
Well, fun tying that together. I mean, the actress who won the Oscar for Children of the Lesser God, the film, will be in the Best Western production.
Marley Matlin. Yeah, no, that's part of what got me thinking about it too.
And also, we're planning an issue around these themes.
We are
in November.
We are planning an issue around these themes.
So if you have thoughts or productions that you think we should be thinking about,
yeah, or
then
wonderful counterexamples. Wait Until Dark. There's a new version of that, and that's a play in which a blind woman is the main character. I don't actually know of any productions which an actual blind or sight impaired person has played the role.
Yeah, there was a big hubbub about the Curious Incident of a Dog in the Nighttime and how they didn't cast an actor on the autism spectrum to play that role.
Right.
And so that's
there's been talk about that. So that we'll try to address all that.
But then that brings back up the question. I mean, what's the divide between character and actor?
There's no divide.
But someone compared, casting a hearing actor in a hard of hearing role as tantamount to yellow face or black face.
Yes, this has been mentioned. We will try to address all those issues in our upcoming issue. Yeah,
we don't have a name for it yet. We're trying to figure that one out too.
Seriously, yeah. We also take suggestions for a wonderful name for a disability themed issue that doesn't just say disability, which is not a word of shame, but not the most catchy name. So, Susie, what do you
doesn't
got for
sell
us?
Those abs.
Yeah, exactly. What do you got, Susie?
I want to recommend, I'm a big fan, as I'm hoped a lot of you are, of Julie Klausner and her podcast, How Was Your Week? And she just did a cabaret show at Joe's Pub in New York, which is kind of a mix of her singing and doing some stand-up. And she wrote and created a new TV show that's produced by Amy Poehler and stars her friend Billy Eichner, who we all love from Billy on the Street, kind of street theater that's videotaped for Comedy Central, I think.
He runs up to people.
He runs up to people and harasses them with celebrities. It's pretty great. But they have a new TV show that's premiering August 5th on Hulu called Difficult People. And they both have, fun performing theater, cabaret roots. And there's a lot of... Andrea Martin plays Julie Klausner's mom. I think Mark Shaman has a guest appearance in the first or second episode. I got to see the first two episodes at Vulture Fest, which is New York Magazine's Culture Festival, a few weeks ago. And it's really entertaining. There's a lot of theater people. It's very funny. Both of them kind of have a little performing theatrical background. So August 5th on Hulu, you can catch Difficult People.
Great. You can listen to Difficult People every week. No, I'm just kidding. Every other week
But Julie has a great podcast, so shout out to How Was Your Week?
Oh, she has a great podcast, too.
Yeah.
All right,
one of my favorite episodes is when she interviewed Alex Timbers, and he talks about that one time he accidentally got Michael Friedman arrested.
Wow.
So go listen to How Was Your Week, Julie Klausner.
I'll hear more about that. So that's another edition of Offscript. Please subscribe to us on iTunes and rate us. I guess that helps people find us. Is that right?
Yes.
All right. And our engineer is deep. So.
And we have good sound this week.
Hopefully. Okay, bye.
Bye.